letter to the editor doesn't get published, you can CC it to your representative or their staffer. And you let them know that, hey, maybe they didn't publish your letter this time, but, you know, you live in their district and you're taking time out of your busy day to express your views. And next time they will publish your letter, or that you'll be talking to your colleagues, your coworkers, your friends, your churches, your unions or whatever. And so they better pay attention to you. The squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? And so you got to squeak.
And that is as good a spot as any to bring this show to a close. I have been speaking with Sanho Tree. He is the director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. It's been a great pleasure, Sanho. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Doug. Always a pleasure.
I'm Doug McVeigh, your host. You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. KBOO.FM on the web. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
And thanks, KBOO members, for your support of listener-supported community radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOO.FM and clicking where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned at 10:15 this morning on KBOO. Flashpoints features an in-depth look at the new Speaker of the House-to-be, Paul Ryan, and the weekly broadcast of the Electronic Intifada. At 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, today looks at alternative perspectives on perceptions and treatments of mental illness. But first, we're going to go right to Air Cascadia. Chris Andre is waiting in the wings, and stay tuned.
Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, October 28, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. We have guests today, two people who know a little bit, they know their way around the economy and finance perhaps better than most. We are fortunate to have Jasmine Tucker joining us. She is an authority on some of the issues that are going on right now. She's with the National Priorities organization, and she is joining us to talk a little bit about this current budget that the White House and congressional lawmakers unveiled. The plan has keeps there a lot. There's a lot about it to like. For one thing, the very fact that it was passed in the first place, but we still have to think about what's about sequestration and what that is, and what it really means for people who are struggling to make ends meet. To that end, we are also going to be speaking with Matt Stennard. He's one of the co-founders of Commonomics, and he'll be talking a bit about postal banking. Matt has been on the program before talking about public banks, public banking, such as what North Dakota has had in place for a long, long time, and is a very, very successful banking system. And the fact that other states have not adopted it so far, it could be attributed solely to pressure and strong arm tactics on the part of the huge mega banks. So that now, however, this has been adopted as Bernie's brilliant idea. Bernie Sanders has taken up the cause of postal banking. It's certainly brilliant in timing and substance, as they say. And his campaign may give credible boost to this idea of providing financial services for people who have not only struggle to manage their own finances, but they are excluded from the banking system in many ways and many times, and instead resort to terrible things like payday loans, which are there's been talk of controlling them, of regulating them, or abolishing them. Abolishing them is obviously the only way to go. Let's start out, though, first, if you don't mind waiting a bit, Matt, if we want to talk first with Jasmine Tucker about the current budget. It's 50-50 defense spending and domestic spending, but here's the thing. Defense spending has we're still waiting to see what's going to be done about infrastructure and schools and so many more domestic issues that are right in front of us. Whereas defense spending, there are indeed wars going on everywhere, but are we really to take the role of the world's cop? So that said, Jasmine, thank you very much for being with us today. We're really glad to have you. This is bipartisan budget agreement. Yeah, it does avoid disaster, though. And I wonder what will happen between now and November 2nd, I believe. And I wonder about a number of other aspects of the budget. Thank you for being with us. First off, can you talk a bit about sequestration? It's something people have a hard time getting around.
Thanks for having me. So back in 2011, you know, we were really sluggishly emerging from a recession after we made major investments in the U.S. That staved off a depression. So that was good. But federal budget deficits were really hot news. They were the big topic, and some members of Congress were insisting on reducing those deficits by cutting federal spending, and they wanted to do that. So they implemented the Budget Control Act of 2011. And so the key feature of that bill was that Congress, you know, this committee in Congress needed to come together to achieve some kind of savings over 10 years, about $1 trillion in savings. And so when they failed to do that, we had this across-the-board spending cuts called sequestration come into effect. And so those went into effect in 2013. And later in 2013, we had the Bipartisan Budget Act, and so that provided temporary relief from these sequestration cuts in 2014 and 2015. But what we're seeing now that we're in fiscal year 2016, which just started at the beginning of this month on October 1st, is that sequestration is going to return for fiscal year 2016. But this new budget, this Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015, that members of Congress and the White House struck earlier this week, that is going to provide some temporary relief, partial relief for sequestration cuts in 2016 and 2017. So you made great points, Chris. There's a lot to like about this this package. You know, namely that we're lifting those sequestration cuts for the domestic spending side. So infrastructure, jobs, education, you know, some of the great things that you were talking about. And we're also looking at the Social Security DI program, the disability insurance program, and making sure that there's not going to be a benefit cut for recipients next year. But you're also hitting the great point that, you know, when we lift sequestration cuts for the domestic side, we're also going to be lifting those cuts for the defense side. And, you know, more than half of our current discretionary budget goes to military spending, about 54 or 55%, and that's a trend that we've been seeing over the last several decades.
Well, within this budget, there is padding for the Pentagon's slush fund. When these budgets are negotiated, what is... no, we are not currently under attack, as far as I know. What justification, what is the overall benefit to Americans to have this enormous defense budget with not only is 50% of the overall budget, but padding also in there for the Pentagon slush fund? What overall benefit is there in having such an enormous? No other nation on earth has, with, you know, with exceptions, has such a huge defense budget, and some of them are under attack. What benefit?
That's a great point, and I do just want to point out that the U.S. we dwarf the next nine countries who spend the next biggest amounts on their military. We spend as much as the next nine countries combined. And, you know, the second spender, which is China, for every $1 they spend, we're spending $3.5. So we really are outspending everyone. And so what's the benefit? I think the answer to that is lawmakers. Lawmakers see the benefit because they have defense contractors in their states, right? So they have a direct interest in keeping defense contracts fluid in their states so that money keeps flowing into their districts. As far as the American people, though, you know, when we're talking about padding, you know, the Pentagon budget, we're talking about an extra, you know, almost $60 billion in just 2016 alone. And when we think about what we could get instead of that, I mean, it's when we look at the trade-offs there, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of jobs, you know, kids going to school, paying for college, you know, wind power, all kinds of other, you know, really great things that we could be doing on the domestic side.
Jasmine, hang on a moment. Hold that thought, because I'm close to being out of time, and I do want to bring Matt in. Matt Stannard joins us now. I want to thank you for that. If you want to stay on the line and participate in this, first we need to welcome Matt Stannard to the KBOO airwaves, talking about postal banking. We've talked about public banking. Matt, can you briefly give listeners an overview? You made six very, very good points, and something we want to talk about some more on the benefits of postal banking and what actually it is, why Bernie Sanders, for that matter, has adopted it.
Certainly, Chris. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm the policy director at Commonomics USA, which you can find information about postal banking and many other things at commonomicsusa.org. The name of the article, of course, is... postal banks are people's banks, and it traces a little bit about the history of postal banking, which we had in the United States for several decades and which much of the rest of the world has. And the basic idea is that basic banking services, basic financial services, including small loans as well as remittances and payday or check cashing, different things like that, could be available at post offices. Those post offices are located in places that are becoming what we call banking deserts, places where for several square miles and entire neighborhoods and entire sections of cities, there are no financial services available for people except very high-priced ones like check cashing and payday loans. Those payday loan offices charge sometimes 350 to 400 percent interest, absolutely ruining people's lives. As you know, Chris, it's very expensive to be poor, and so postal banking is a way that allows people to have access to public-based financial services instead of paying an arm and a leg to these check cashers and payday lenders.
And, of course, it's a way, too, for people to break out of that cycle of poverty. And that is what is adding to, was contributing to, made, is a force that increases the gap between the wealthy and the poor.
Because it's very expensive to be poor. And so things like basic financial services and certainly things like payday advances or and check cashing and remittance services should be made available to people at a much lower price than they're paying when they walk into a payday loan place.
So what effect, we've got just a couple, we've got, well, 30 seconds left. I'm sorry that we are running out of time. What people listening to this and wanting to set up a post, is it possible for people to use a post office now as a banking service? And what can we do to make that happen?
Right now we don't have full banking services at post offices. It's something that Bernie Sanders is campaigning for, but it's also something that the Campaign for Postal Banking is banking for. So I would urge people to Google Campaign for Postal Banking and also to visit Commonomics USA. There are actions that we can take right now to get the federal government and the United States Postal Service working for us by implementing banking services.
And Elizabeth Warren, too, also is on board with this. Many people who are in a position to make it happen are working in this direction. CommonomicsUSA.org is the place to go to find out more. I want to thank both of my guests today, very, very generous with their time, Jasmine Tucker and Matt Stannard. Thank you so much for being with us. This has been Cascadia for Wednesday, October 28, 2015. Tammy Dean engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Tammy. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOOAM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.